Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning, James.
That's right. We have Christopher. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, both of you.
She's here, too. They're all here. All my nightmares in one place.
I've been hearing about Catherine for months now, and this is the first time I actually get a chance to see and talk to her.
Right. Yes. Hi. It's a pleasure.
This is a pleasure for me, too. This is great.
Finally.
Oh, do I even need to be here?
No, you can leave anytime.
Yes, hi, James.
I mean, I was just going to talk about my cat and my dog, but
the introduction has been made.
What's happening?
Oh, she's crazy. You know, you've both seen my dog. She's about 45 pounds. It's kind of a middleweight dog, black from head to toe.
Mm-hmm. I love you guys' podcast. That's why I was so excited when you asked me to come on.
Yeah, he didn't hesitate when I asked. Anyway, back to Cleo.
Okay.
The dog, the black dog. who looks a little bit like a hellhound. It was 102 degrees yesterday, and I noticed that she went outside, which she does all the time, but she just plops down in the middle of the sun. She goes in the backyard, not in the shade, but in the sun, and just plops down and sits out there for like an hour.
Oh, no.
In the sun. She's a black dog. It's 102 degrees outside. And I'm staring at her, and she's giving me this look like, what? What? Why are you looking at me? Go away.
Aw.
I'm sunbathing.
Maybe she has arthritis, and it felt good.
No, she's fine. She's just weird. She's a phoenix dog. She's a weird phoenix dog.
She is.
And then last night, it was down to like 102 degrees, you know, after the sun goes down. It gets down to almost 100 degrees. Right. And I noticed my cat was asleep outside on the table. I was like, what are you doing? It's 102 degrees outside and you're asleep on the table. Come inside.
Did they finally come inside?
Oh, he did eventually on his own time. But those are my cats. This is not a cat show. This is not a dog show. This is a show about art and about explaining why it's so bad.
Some of it's bad.
So this week we are talking about Jean Michael Basquiat.
No. It's Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Oh, my God.
I know. So you just love
so
to mangle the name.
Oh, I do.
Well, that's his name.
Don't you think it has a lot to do with the fact that he had a Haitian dad and a Puerto Rican mom?
Well, I think, it was flipped. Yeah, it was a Haitian mom and a whatever. What difference does it make?
So I'm guessing everybody pronounced his name differently.
I think so, yeah.
I would imagine in high school with his comrade in street art, Al Diaz probably called
him
Johnny Boy.
I just love the name Jean-Michel. I just love it.
Well, maybe that's why you like
flows.
Him so much.
Yeah, and I like the hair.
It's too feminine for me.
What don't you like about Basquiat?
Basquiat, so now we're calling him Basquiat. Okay. I set the tone. I tried looking at his work and finding some resonance with it, and I just couldn't. Over the course of looking at all the works, I can see there's a certain staccato to his method of painting that seems consistent. So I guess when you scribble enough, you get a consistency to the scribble, but I just couldn't relate to any of it.
Oh, wow.
And I can relate to paintings on different levels. I can relate just strictly to the aesthetic of it, just to the actual physical paint on the canvas, which is how I do with Jackson Pollock and people like de Kooning. I look at him and I kind of see hints of de Kooning in there. And I'm not really a big fan of de Kooning either, but when I look at de Kooning, at least I can make some sense of the paint, the paint itself. I can't find anything in... You pronounce his name for me, please. I'm going to try.
Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Basquiat. I can't seem to find any connection with Basquiat.
It seems to me, if you were young, and that's the first time I was exposed to him in my maybe late teens.
Yes.
And I was in Venice Beach and someone had brought him up and some stuff I'd seen on the walls there that I guess looked like his. It looked like that skull one. It's probably, you know, one of his most famous pieces. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, wow. God, that's really cool.
Right.
And it's still cool with the young kids now. I mean, you can buy Doc Martens right now with his artwork on it.
Oh, okay.
Do they cost $35 million too?
What's that again?
Do they cost $35 million? I mean, that's what his paintings are selling for now.
Yeah, you said that, but I looked up his artwork. I think the last one was going for $110 million.
Yeah, okay. They're like 100. And that one, I think the original skull, like that skull, the penultimate skull, as it were, was like the highest sold Basquiat painting ever.
That is insane.
That image is pretty iconic.
When I was a kid, I would go to Brooklyn occasionally because my mom's side of the family lived there. Mm-hmm. And I remember with my old 35 millimeter taking pictures of all the graffitied walls, mm-hmm. the artwork in the Brooklyn area is superior to the graffiti I saw elsewhere at the time, you know, well, the early time. 80s. But mm-hmm. the stuff now is amazing. Phoenix is amazing. There's just murals everywhere.
Yes. Yes.
Most cities now have a spot where you can find beautiful murals, you know, and they pop up. Mm-hmm. And they're amazing pieces with thoughtful art. But back in the 80s, not so much. A lot of just tagging and words and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I said, once it was brought to my attention, I was like, wow, I need to capture this and really capture this on film. And I wish I had that old 35 millimeter mm-hmm. black and whites I used to take. Maybe at some point I got lucky and actually captured one of his pieces actually on the walls. As you probably know, he went under the name S-O-M.
Yeah, Samo.
Samo. It's like yeah. Samo, Samo. Nothing ever changes. That was cool. Right. And like I said, his audience will always appeal to youthful mm-hmm. youths and probably always will do that.
I think so, too. I think what I was, you know, a lot of his work, some of his work doesn't resonate. I'll give you that, James. You know, like the stuff that's strictly, you know, letters and words. And, you know, I don't get it. And I think in the original show notes, when we were talking about doing the podcast, and I had sent some stuff like, is Jean-Michel Basquiat like a genius or, you know, whatever. And, but I think like the more, the linear drawings and the skulls and the flattening of the images. And it's like, I was reading something about him the other day and said that one of his favorite texts, his mother had given him a copy, as the story goes, of a Grey's Anatomy textbook. And he would, that's where he started doing some of the heads and the body drawings. It was like a study. He used it as almost a study to do some of his illustrations. And some of that I find interesting. He does credit Pollock as being an inspiration. And I see some of that in like the freneticness. And I think the underlying, I don't know, I hate to say psychopathology, but you know, it's well known he was an addict. His mother had, you know, some issues and was hospitalized repeatedly, as the story goes.
It also sounded like he came from a pretty normal middle class background.
It does. Yeah. It's so
lower middle class. Come on.
Lower middle class. Yeah.
That neighborhood definitely did not cater to regular middle class. At least the areas he was, I don't want to say tagging, but starting his, well, he's kind of an enigma, right? So he keeps doing these, well, he starts off probably in the evening times, sneaking out, tagging walls, and slowly developing his style. But yet at the same time, he's a member of the museum, starting at like 6 years old. His parents got him involved in art.
Isn't that interesting? I thought that was so interesting.
It gives you an appreciation for him because really art, in my opinion, is not art unless some thought went into it. And as you have said to me, James, in the past, it provokes thought. And I think since he started at 6 years old looking at art museums, by the time he becomes a teen and experimenting on these walls in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. I think he really being thoughtful and he is trying to send a message. And the only reason why, in my opinion, it speaks to youth today. It provokes thought. Teens are slightly angry because they don't exactly know where they fit in the world today. And they see this art and they go, yeah, that speaks to me. He has this one piece. If I remember correctly, it's called Irony of a Black Cop or Black Policeman. And I think it speaks especially to Black Americans. You know, they don't understand why they have the situation. On the one hand, the police are like the enemy, but yet at the same time, the policeman comes around and he is the one that breaks up the fight or the problem that's creating violence in their community. That's why I think...
Well, this is definitely the last time you're going to be on the show, Christopher, because you two are ganging up on me.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's not ganging up.
No, it's not at all. It's just,
it's not.
I feel like I'm in the minority here because I don't see it. Pieces like that, I need to feel it when I'm looking at it. I don't want to have to read about it or read into the situation. The work needs to stand on its own. You know, he claims to be a self-taught artist. I don't have any argument with that. But I picked up on when I was reading through some of his interviews, and disturbed me to some degree. If he's a self-taught artist, so he doesn't have any formal training, And he probably doesn't have a lot of information about art history, even though sometimes he claims to. What disturbed me was that he was talking about Dadaism and how that was his inspiration. And that bothers me because Dadaism is literally anti-art. So if you start with that as your basis of what inspires you, and you look at Armat's urinal or Duchamp's urinal, that's art. That's part of art history, but that itself is not art. It was described at the time as being the anti-art. If you start with Dadaism as the basis of your art, I don't see how that... It made a lot of sense to me once I saw him say that. These are his own words. His work is kind of hollow. I find it's kind of hollow.
Oh.
There's this one piece he did. It's kind of interesting to me because I'm always interested in self-portraits. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's Renaissance, whatever period we're talking about. You get... Not that the face can tell you who a person is, but something about what the artist has chosen to put in about themselves. And he has this, it's basically a silhouette, and he's reaching out to what looks like it could be a canvas, but it actually, it kind of looks like painting from a window. All he is just putting on a canvas, or not even really putting on a canvas, couldn't even afford a canvas, but maybe garbage he found. Mm-hmm. And then he's recapturing it on what he sees. And I guess it's hollow in the fact that a lot of his works are very similar. And, you know, it's like Picasso's blue period. Everything's blue or some hue of purple. I know they call it the blue period, but it all looks purple to me. And Jean-Michel evolves like a lot of artists do, like his last year of life. He moves away from this primitive style and he starts... really looking at other artists. So he might has that one piece you might be familiar with. It's called, oh my gosh, it's like Leonardo da Vinci work. Oh, Writing Death. Oh yeah, sorry. So when you see the piece, it almost looks like he's, maybe it could be himself, but maybe it's not, but it's definitely a black man riding on this broken skull, half human, half horse, kind of a thing. I think that's how he was starting to see the world. That and the fact that he was a huge heroin addict and seeing this dark. I assume he's going into these heroin houses where people are laying around and they look dead.
Right.
Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong.
I haven't been in a lot of heroin houses.
I haven't been in any heroin houses. So.
Me neither.
Well, I think we have a field trip for later today.
Oh my gosh. I'll have to put pants on, I guess.
I think there are some. Well, I don't know. I don't think that's a requirement for those kinds of places. It may even help us give us some cred so we can get in.
But
I think there's some place in South Phoenix. I think I've been past a few of these places.
Oh, gosh.
I think I could probably find one or two.
Yeah. I think I just responded to not necessarily just the color. I mean, I sound like so mundane, but the colors, but just the frenetic use of the pigments on the canvas. And I sense energy. And his work sometimes to me is bland. Like I said, I don't like the stuff that's just straight up words like the graffiti evolved.
I do like
the images of the faces. And I think it's because I had this small love affair with some of the Dia de los Muertos stuff several years ago. And I started doing a study of skulls and bones. And I just did this whole, I went off on black and white charcoal depictions of femurs and shoulder blades. I mean, it was just craziness. But I think I like that. It reminds me of that in some way before that was a kind of thing. It's reminiscent to me of outsider art. And I'm not sure that he was completely untrained. I know at 7, he was at a junior member of the Brooklyn Museum of Art. And then I also read an article last night. I was like, where did he train? And all it said that at an early age, his mother enrolled him at a prestigious art school somewhere close to home. But there was no documentation of that. I mean, it could have been.
Well, he's a self-described, self-trained artist, which I'm always a little skeptical of. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter.
No.
The work needs to stand on its own.
Right. And to me, it still does stand on its own because I sense it's almost like that outside. If you accept that he's a self-trained artist, and again, I don't care. And it looks like a self-trained artist. And it reminds me a lot of outsider art or the art brute or there's a gallery was like actually an art therapy venue for emotionally disturbed individuals or whatever. They were there for art therapy. And you'd walk in and you'd see a lot of the same kind of energy on their canvas. Does that even make any sense? I mean,
yeah,
it was
it does.
This mentally ill art, basically. And it was amazing. And that was, I always went. I wish I could remember the name of the gallery. And they'd feature their artists. And you'd just see people with like, you know, there'd be image after image of someone like facing a corner with this weird, this frenetic kind of linear movement. And I think I see some of that in his work. For some reason, that appeals to me.
Well, you said energy too. So if, for example, if you ever get a chance to go into Venice Beach, there's a lot of self-trained artists and amateurs, artists that are out there trying to sell their work.
Yeah.
They literally are in the same or similar situation. They're probably raised halfway decent in a decent neighborhood. They have nothing now, or they chose not to have anything now. And they're painting on wood or palm tree fronds or palms that have fallen down. They have old boxes. There's kind of like an energy to that. When you mm-hmm. go into the canvas and the more refined pieces like you would see in a museum, mm-hmm. not that Basquiat, even though he's in a museum, that energy of non-traditional canvas, it brings mm-hmm. like this energy to it. There's something different about this.
There is.
And the fact that a lot of this stuff he probably found, right? I think
That's true to some degree, but I mean, he was painting a lot on canvas and he was painting a lot of wood, and the wood wasn't always necessarily reclaimed wood.
Yeah, that's true.
The materials he's using, there's nothing new about that.
It seems a little derivative.
And I don't mind, you know, you pick your medium, right? But, mm-hmm. and I've seen that on a couple of articles where they hang their hat on this idea that he was painting on wood and that's some kind of magical process. It's not an amount, everyone paints on wood at some point. And it's people were painting on newspaper. People were painting on everything.
Well, writing on death is a piece of steel, and that can't be cheap.
I've painted on steel, and, you know, it can be cheap. Depends on where you get it.
Or find. Right.
You know, maybe some of the dissonance, if I may call it dissonance, you see in his work is that he comes off, on one hand, he's this guy, you know, tagging walls, is a late teen, early 20s, whatever, and then it takes off, you know, and I don't know if you ever saw, there was a movie called Basquiat with Jeffrey Wright played Basquiat, David Bowie plays Warhol. And it was an interesting, you know, kind of depiction, maybe somewhat fantastical. I think someone who knew him did buy the rights to the film. And it's a very interesting piece. But he just kind of, you know, as the story goes in the movie, and I'm not sure how accurate, he just walks in. He was selling his postcards. And I read an article last night. They said, you know, this gal was like, oh, I used to see his postcards on the subways. And people would just pick him up. He'd just lay him around. Mm-hmm. And he sold some to Warhol. And Warhol's like, oh, this is great. And then he kind of became part of that movement.
The factory.
You know, he was enveloped into the factory. You know, so up until that point. And so I think, you know, there is this persona of this outsider artist, this guy Tagenwald, this simpleton in some ways, just self-taught, not simpleton. He was very bright, spoke three languages. People do acknowledge him as being very, very intelligent. But he, you know, all of a sudden he takes that energy and all of this. And now he's in the factory. Like he's with Warhol, the guy, so to speak, of that
era.
It's
what you said earlier, James, with him being self-proclaimed. I mean, Warhol being the king of marketing at that time.
Exactly.
And so
now
you have this kid that's pretty good at marketing. He's throwing postcards around so that his mm-hmm. pieces are recognizable. And then he's selling them to others. This is all marketing. Warhol probably saw this great artist doing something different, which was part of his marketing scheme. He says, come along, let's do our marketing together.
it's more celebrity than about the actual work. That's how I look at it.
There is
that dichotomy. I really believe that. But, you know, so to paint on wood or to paint on steel or to paint on a palm
it's
tree
just a
frond.
It's just a story to make
Well,
the
it
art
is
sell.
A story. It is a story. But, you know, the background is, I mean, he had benefactors. There were people who were supporting his art. There were people who were commissioning his art. And there were people who were showing it in galleries in Soho and all over the cities. And so he wasn't just some schmuck like doing a bunch of smack, dabbling and throwing paint or something. I mean, there was a method to this madness. So I think you can look at it from two aspects. So whether the work appeals or not, I think sometimes the story gets romanticized.
Well,
he was supported.
There's clearly a lot of politics around him. But again, I want to try to strip that away because it's very easy just to attack the structure that he's in and see how vapid it, you know, the high art world is. You know, getting back to the work, I'm repeating myself, but it just, I didn't find anything to connect to. Mm-hmm. And what was really funny is one of the links you sent me, Catherine, was a Sotheby's video. Was a short retrospective, and of course, it sounds very erudite, and they're literally calling out famous painters from the past, like Leonardo da Vinci and Francis Bacon,
and that's all marketing too, right?
What's that?
They're marketing.
Oh, of course, it's Sotheby's. Yeah, they're just trying to sell.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's all marketing. I that's why I sent that to you.
It seemed like the perfect thing for this kind of artwork. Is it the work that they're actually trying to sell great work, or are they just trying to sell something that they can mark up?
Oh.
It's just a commodity.
What you think of his pieces where being a doodler, a heavy doodler when I was a kid, all through high school, I would draw on absolutely anything I could. The back of books, the desk, mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. And he has this collection of work. It kind of reminds me of a high school kid doodling on the back of his book. It's like, let's see how much I can get on the back of this page that I do not own. Let's see how much I can get in there. Before the bell rings. And Basquiat looks like a mixture of a bunch of doodles, like you were saying earlier, with like phrases and words, some being interesting, some maybe being less interesting. What did you think of, they're like collages of little figures all over the place?
I'm a big fan of collage. I do a lot of collage. I always have. And so I like it. I liked it. I didn't find that necessarily disturbing.
I think that actually gets the one thing that I found, I guess, engaging was I saw a lot of his sketches or paintings. You know, he and I agreed on one thing, and there's really no difference between painting and sketching. It's it's a continuum. You can have paint and graphite and other materials in there, and trying to say one is an illustration or a painting or a drawing, it's kind of silly to make that distinction. But I did see a lot of these drawings that he had of heads, and it was... What I found interesting about that was he was going through a process of exploration of rendering heads in all these different ways. So I think if I was forced to put a show together of his work, I would probably pick the heads. and because it's such a breadth of work.
I agree with that. His beds are the best.
Damn it. Now you made me say something nice about him.
Oh, calm down, James.
Damn it, I lost.
Eat a cookie.
I can't eat the cookies. The Costco doesn't have any more of the coconut cookies. So
I couldn't find any. I was going to surprise you if I ever saw you face to face again. I can't find them anywhere.
Yeah, I know. So now I've had to go back to graham crackers.
Oh, God.
I love graham crackers, but they don't go as well with coffee as those coconut cookies do.
Melt some marshmallows on them.
What's that?
Melt some marshmallows on them in the microwave.
Absolutely not. That is disgusting. Oh, my God.
Okay, back to Basquiat.
No. Did you happen to notice, you said heads.
What's that?
You said heads, James. A lot of his work I thought was kind of interesting because it went from the belly button up.
Oh, there are a lot of balls in his work, too. A lot of balls in his work.
I don't think I noticed that.
Oh, his full figure. He's a lot of full figures, and, you know, he's not shy.
Huh. I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
All right, Christopher, you can do that on your own time.
You know, to me, it's the energy of some of the pieces. And again, it's not all of the pieces, but like the heads definitely stand out. The collages definitely stand out. And I sense this energy. I sense this underlying angst. And there's something about it. Like the more I look at it, like I said a couple podcasts ago, the more I get sucked in. And that feeling has retained like over time. I mean, this is over 20 years. I've been probably staring at the same pieces. I don't think I've ever seen one in person, irrespective of where I was looking at art museums. But they suck me in at the same level, and I get the same kind of feeling of this frenetic activity. I can see motion on the canvas. And it's something that, you know, particularly when I look at his work that I'm not particularly drawn to. It always begs the question to me, like we always go back to, you know, I can do that. And can I? I've experimented somewhat with putting words on canvas, cutting up things, looking like some crazy person. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of different things that no one will ever see because it's not good. But, you know, so I just don't think that my work transmits the same kind of energy, nor would it do that over time. And that's what I respect.
I wonder if the situation that he found himself in with Warhol and the galleries of New York City, which, let's be frank, are not there for anyone's benefit but their own. In a really mercenary way, more so than most businesses. I wonder if that environment tainted him. I wonder if, you know, he got false praise and bad responses. And if he hadn't had that, if he'd worked in solo, maybe he would have developed a different style, something that I would have approved of. And, you know, it's all about what James approves of. So there's that.
Okay. I don't know. What do you think of that hypothesis, Christopher?
Well, I fear that with his affection for heroin, the story might have been shorter.
Yeah, but where did that come from?
Basquiat said repeatedly, at least that's how I remember it, that heroin was a part of his work, almost like mm-hmm. Alice in Wonderland and opium, right? Would that work exist without opium? I wonder if this artwork would exist if it wasn't for heroin. It's a terrible thing to say. And maybe perhaps some great works throughout history have basically come out of drug abuse. But the truth of the matter is people, humans, are constantly trying to capture their youth, where we have this creative mind and all these connections in our brain can go any direction. They're not solid yet. And right. So how, as an adult, where things have started to solidify in the brain, starting to go down a one-way path, how can we start branching out? And drugs are a fast and relatively easy way of doing it. You have guys like Mark Twain who, you know, travel all over the world and try to see new things to get creative. Or mm-hmm. you can sit in a room all by yourself and snort or shoot drugs or smoke. And a lot of artists take the deathly shortcut.
I think that's a really deceptive method of doing it, though, because the results generally don't produce anything of consequence. I can't draw a line with Basquiat specifically here and know exactly how connected his work is to that drug usage. But it seems to me that most people, after they come off their high, thought they were doing great work while they're on the high. But right. then once they're down, they realize that was nonsense. You know, it doesn't really make any sense in the light of day.
He definitely
That's
did
the story
not
I've heard
admit
over and over
to
again.
That. He said that? His work was what it was because heroin is the connection to art, people. It's that. That's how he made his connection. Look, if you show up to a party and everybody likes heroin and you have heroin, you're the party favorite.
Yeah,
and so he can make
party.
Connections. It go back to the factory and the marketing and everything. I mean, it's terrible, but he was literally marketing heroin at the time. I just kind of wanted to move to something related or not related. Being an African-American or a Black American, or he's been contributed to being probably the first Black American artist that is respectfully recognized as an artist. And I wonder if the drug use was a big part of him getting that rocking and rolling.
Well, I think it was probably part of the political machinations behind the scenes, you know, why he was chosen by the galleries. I'm sure that played part of their math in going into who they choose to promote. And that sounds very self-serving, but I think that's what the art scene in New York has always been that way. So there's no question in my mind that was part of it. I'm not trying to take away from his art, and it's more of a damnation or condemnation of the art scene than of him.
Right, which is interesting because the whole thing with the same old at the beginning, it was like same old shit, and he was doing it kind of to thumb his nose at the uptight middle class. And then it seems like he bought into
middle
it.
Middle class or upper class?
Middle class.
Middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And then he fell into the upper class.
Yeah, he said Sama was born as a tool for mocking bogusness. And he found it hilarious that the uptight middle class pseudos in Manhattan had fallen for his ruse.
Yep.
Oh, I don't think he ever got into high class, or I don't even think he made it into middle class. I think he consistently just lingered. He made lots of money. My understanding, because of his heroin addiction, most of that money went out the door buying toys and drugs. He never got a chance to enjoy the money he made.
Well, I'm saying, though, that he was selling into the high society.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
So he was taking advantage of them, which, you know, I fully support. If you can, sucker's born every minute, and a lot of them have a lot of money. So take as much
right.
of it as you can get.
Right.
It is, on the one hand, it is a great scam. If you can.
Again, the art scam.
If you can sell a $10 painting for $10 million, that's a pretty good markup. I mean, Apple doesn't even have those markups. I've said that before.
You've said that before.
Repeated
but
joke.
No, and I'm okay with you saying it again. I think it's an interesting observation. But he said, they're doing exactly what we thought they'd do. We tried to make it sound profound, and they think it actually is. That's
so that was his quote?
Correct. It was in an interview. I'll just read the whole quote out of this article. It says, in an interview with the Village Voice, a teenage Basquiat said anti-materialist Samo was born, in quotes, as a tool for mocking bogusness. And, in quotes, I found it hilarious that the uptight middle-class pseudos in Manhattan had fallen for the ruse. They're doing exactly what we thought they'd do, he said. We tried to make it sound profound, and they think it is actually so.
Wow.
So that was the same-o, and that was all of that. And so you go, and, you know, so that was very calculated in some respects. You know, too, I think if people call him a genius, I think that was a smart marketing move. You know, you're writing words, and a lot of that was words. Some of the original same-o stuff, the Wayback Machine, if you look at pictures of his work, it was words. And that, I don't have any resonance with that at all. And some of it doesn't even make sense.
I think of the show called Community, and one of the episodes, I think it's this character, Abed. Anyways, one of the characters decides to make a movie, and he starts playing this Jesus type, and he starts doing things that he thinks Jesus would say. And eventually, just by saying profound words and acting profound, the next thing you know, the whole college is praising him for being godlike. And then, of course, awesome. He realizes this is just a game and quickly escapes the plot. But that's kind of, that quote kind of makes me basically about in this context. If
right.
you say so enough things
if you,
that they want to hear and they're searching for what you're pitching or selling, they're eventually going to put you on the pedestal as a specialized poster boy.
So yes. What you're saying here, Christopher, is fake it until you make it.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Well, thank God I got there first.
And a lot of artists have said that. I mean, I'm sure you guys have been in a position sometime where you couldn't wait to get where you wanted to be. And when you finally got there, now what do I do? And you have to kind of fake it until you feel comfortable.
I hate that saying. I really do hate that saying.
Right.
I think it's really a bad kind of motif or metaphor to use to get through life.
No, I'm not saying you should, but you know, it can't hurt. Anyways.
And you're a bad person for saying that, Christopher.
Yes, I am.
No, he's not. Yeah, I like Christopher. Stop.
The two of you are just self-important. See, when I have one of you at a time, I can crush you individually, but the two of you are helping one another, and you're combining forces.
Sorry.
And overthrowing my evil powers.
Well, we really knew each other before, and we had this all planned out. We even wore matching t-shirts. I mean,
I'm just
get
a
it.
Sucker.
Hey, just really quickly, I kind of want to go back to his really early beginnings, because we've talked about how Andy Warhol has had a lot of influence on him, especially with marketing. And
right.
I had briefly brought this up a few minutes ago. He has a friend that gets nearly zero credit for the same-o tag that they were using as high school kids, whose name is Al Diaz, who is still an active artist. And if you'd like to see Jean Miguel's style carrying on into the modern times, he's still active producing work. He's got a lot of stuff. And even in the last few months, dealing with the police issue, which I thought was kind of funny because his childhood friend had this famous piece, the one we were just talking about, Irony of a Policeman. Al Diaz has a piece right now. It looks to be his own version, which is a masked policeman.
I'll link to that. I'll link to that in the show notes.
Okay, good. I didn't dive that deep into Diaz.
Oh, you do. You sounds like you dove pretty deep.
I do. Yeah, not into Diaz though, and that was one thing I just got tired.
No, Diaz,
talk
I'm
more
sorry.
About his work, Christopher.
Well, let's not get. We
you
need to wrap
go
it up
into,
pretty
okay.
soon.
I guess all I was saying is just that you were talking about Andy Warhol being such an influence on him.
Yeah.
Al Diaz were probably co-working together and feeding off each other as kids, and in the end, Basquiat has his last year where heroin finally does what it always does,
right.
Put you in a depression. You start acting in a ways that are not in your best interest, and he dies. It may not have been his last piece, but closely toward the end of his death, which obviously people would say, obviously that was a premonition, but that's not necessarily true. But you start having sad thoughts when you're feeling sad.
Right.
So
yes, you do.
Well, that's a wonderful note to wrap it up on. Is there any upsides here? I guess we're talking about an artist who died at the age of, what is it, 27?
27.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to wrap that up on a happy note.
I think the happy note is I'm glad that his work got out there. I mean, I really am. I like his work. I probably will always like his work. Not all of it. And I think there was a message. And if Diaz is carrying on in the same spirit of the same-o and doing political content, I'm down for that. I think that's important. And, you know, the factory. And I mean, there's always like the work, which may or may not stand on its own based on the interpretation of the person who's looking at it. And then there's like the kind of the factory. I mean, you know, like the whole engine that makes these people famous, that supports their work, that twists their message, that makes money off of them, you know, in perpetuity to some extent, because he's never going to garner the millions that are currently commanded for his pieces. So
he's definitely an artist worth discussion like we just had today. I wanted to say thank you so much for inviting to your show. I hope you invite me again someday.
Oh, absolutely. It was so much fun. Thanks.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't do as well in this one as I hoped to. I certainly didn't get a point this time. I think I lost the point. I think you guys got the point this time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Point to the C&C. C&C. But there's one upside from my point of view.
What?
Catherine, now that we've spent 40 minutes talking about Gene Michael Basket, we never have to mention him again, right?
Aw, maybe we will in passing.
You will. You can't stop talking about
him. I can't stop. I know. I just, I don't know what it is. Well, I do know what it is. I've said what it is. So, anyway.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for coming on, guys.
All right. You too.
Thank you.
Okay, bye, guys.
You all have a good rest of the day.